You're listening to the TrekMate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
Worf, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Worf, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation. Tonight's episode is Unification 2. I'm Chris from Bryce.
And I'm James from London.
And I'm Lou from Septimus Minor.
So Chris, you mentioned Risa. Is it warm up in Scotland now? Because it's been far, far, far too hot in the south.
It's not as warm as you guys are getting it at the moment, but it's very sticky.
And by the way, Lou, when I say warm, I think I'm talking like 28 degrees, which let me convert that into Fahrenheit for you.
It may be in the 80s, I think.
I don't need.
Yeah, it says 82.
I was going to say, Google right now says London is 21 Celsius. Fahrenheit.
Yeah, it's uncomfortably hot. I can barely sleep at night.
Really?
And the kids have been wakened through the night as well. Yeah, I mean, this is all true.
The key that people need to remember is this is unusual for us, so we aren't prepared. We don't have aircon in any houses. So nothing gets cooled down for 11 months of the year, and we just spend a month being really hot.
Wow.
Although the word really there is a bit relative.
Right now, we're at 32 Celsius, which is 89 Fahrenheit. Let's see what Glasgow is right now. Oh, my goodness. Glasgow in UK says it's 14 degrees Celsius and 58 Fahrenheit.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Beautiful weather there. So we're only about 30 degrees Fahrenheit over you.
Yeah, it's also late evening, so
yeah,
it's cooled down since then.
Yeah, that is true. It's nice and bright and sunny here. So, last we talked to each other was 3 weeks ago in real life, but last week for the show. How have you been doing in the last few days?
Has it really been 3 weeks since we had that election night?
I was going to say, yeah. Well, no.
Yeah, it is. No, it's 2 weeks.
2 weeks, yeah.
Yeah,
it's 2 weeks. And we still don't have a government.
We don't.
Are
you suggesting that you have at least a Scottish government?
No, I think technically we have a minority government. Because we got the exit polls that happened while we were recording 2 weeks ago. Well, almost spot on.
The thing is that it's in particular in the UK, right? The concept of a quote unquote government is not it's actually not a formal thing, other than someone goes to the Queen, someone says, "I reckon that I can command a majority in the Houses of Parliament," and then she says, "All right, okay then," and that's about it. And then it's the transition of a government, even when you have like crushing election defeats. It's a lot of it is really, the defeated candidate comes forward and says that, unfortunately, I'm not in a position to be able to command a majority. Yeah. But if they don't want to do that, they don't have to. And they could stay, quote unquote, in government as long as they wish. Now, they won't be able to pass any legislation. They won't be able to do anything. But there's actually nothing really preventing you from, from sitting there when you don't have any ability to execute any power. Now, eventually, the opposition parties will get together and put a vote of no confidence through. But a lot of this kind of works on a a very kind of old-fashioned definitions of what things are. We don't have a particularly stable government with any significant amount of endorsement. Mm. It's a relatively correct way of saying it.
It's very concerning that the pro-union party that we have throughout the most of the UK can't do a deal with the pro-union party in Northern Ireland to put together that majority in the Commons. And yet these are the same people we're expecting to go and do the Brexit negotiations. So they can't get the easy bit right. What chance have we got of them doing the hard bit right?
Well, I have to say that, so we should probably edit this stuff out. It really did tickle me that after the election, so we have always elections on Thursdays, and it really tickled me that the DUP weren't going to negotiate over Sunday because Sunday was a day of rest. And it tickled me something chronic because, yes, we're in that world now.
Yeah, over here we tend to be quite amazed that the religious aspect seems to have such a control over American politics. We seem to be sort of removed enough from that it doesn't really happen until now. It's not really a surprise given it's involved Northern Ireland, where they've been known to have religious tensions at times.
Sorry, but you're from Glasgow, right?
Yes. We are a microcosm of that same religious tension. Except we tend to exploit it through football.
Yeah, actually, in a way, it's a good release mechanism.
Okay. Well then, you were certainly right about your predictions, I guess. Huh?
Oh yeah, that too. Anyway, enough politics. Let's move on to intergalactic politics.
Mm-hmm. Let's get some unifications going on.
If we go from our own diplomacy to cowboy diplomacy. So, the synopsis for tonight's show is: on Romulus, Picard and Data meet with Spock, who claims to be trying to reunite Romulans and Vulcans. While Spock works to achieve his goal, powers within the Romulan government seek to pervert his mission into an invasion of the Federation. This is the 8th episode of Season 5 of Star Trek The Next Generation. The original release date is November 11th, 1991. It was written by Rick Berman and Michael Piller and directed by Cliff Bull, the Bullion himself. Mm-hmm. Guest stars include Stephen Root as Kavada, Malachi Throne as Pardek, Norman Large as Neral, Daniel Roebuck as Jarn, William Bastiani as Omag, Vidal Peterson as Datan, Harriet Leader as Amari, Denise Crosby as Sela, and special guest star Leonard Nimoy as Ambassador Spock. So what do we think about this episode?
Go on. What do you think?
This always happens. You never give them when you state, so what do we think about this episode, ? You should put underneath it, I think, ... to give them a bit of encouragement. Otherwise, you keep having them stop there. There you go. That's
perfect. So I think it's brilliant. I think it's a great follow-on from the first part.
Okay.
I think it's a little part.
Almost as good, huh? Almost as bad. Or something like that. Okay, James, what about you?
Okay, I'm not convinced that this is as good as the first part. But in a way, I don't think you can take it away. And you know, no one's going to watch the first part of Unification and then go, well, that's it for me. Hmm. So you obviously, I actually personally think you have to see Unification 1 and 2 as, you know, despite them having very different... They have obviously intertwined storylines, but they are different now. We have the story around Spock that we didn't really have before, at least him in person and the political kind of mission that he's on. I don't think it's as good as the first part, but I still really love it, and I think it's a great farewell, at least within the TNG universe, to the Spock character. I know he obviously comes back. Well, I think technically after this, he comes back in Star Trek VI, and then obviously 09. But, what do you mean,
You said he comes back in Star Trek VI. Actually, from what I understand, the way I feel about this, he said, as you know, history has yada yada what I've done to Captain Kirk. Now, you know, Spock, obviously, if you're talking, comes on a screen again. He does come on later for Star Trek VI. But as far as the 24th century, Star Trek VI is already done and over with. So.
Yeah, no, sure. I mean, obviously, like 90 years ago or so.
Right.
Yeah, in terms of the timeline within Star Trek, then yes, you're right. But this episode aired in November and was intentionally done to be a effective promotional trailer for the sixth movie, which came out in the December of 1991. So, in terms of Spock's appearance on screen, this is his penultimate one in the primary universe.
Right. So, if we go with the timeline, his next one will be in the J.J. Abrams screw-up.
Yeah.
Well, I always considered like the Spock, you know, the what people consider Spock Prime, and I have big problems with associating the term Prime with the originals, but don't ask me why that is. But I always considered that character, so the older Leonard Nimoy Spock, to actually be this guy, not some kind of parallel. So I would consider old Spock to be this dude, and then he obviously branches off and creates multiple universes.
Mm-hmm. Too many Spocks in one place. Okay. Me, I think this is almost as good. I'm not sure about equal, but I do kind of like it. I do like this one just as much as the previous one. We find out what's really going on. You think, Spock, you can't be this... You can't... Spock, you can't be this dumb, naive Spock. But he's not. I got a feeling Spock knows what's going on. And like he says, I will play the part they'll have me play. And all of those little pieces, all the little things in part one, the Vulcan deflector array, the Ferengi, they all start to come together in this one, and it all makes perfect sense. And again, we'll see if the Romulans get away with what the Romulans try. They haven't in the past. We'll see if they can today.
I think it's worth emphasizing what you just mentioned there about how the parts come together, because I think up until now we've really only had examples of two parts episodes where they write themselves into a corner, they step away for like a 6 month or a 4 month gap in between seasons, go on holiday, and you know, in the case of Best of Both Worlds, right, it was supposed to be Michael Piller wrote it and then said so long, and he had no intention of coming back to solve the problems that he originally had in the first part of the script. Whereas this is really the first part, this is the first two-part episodes where they do plant things in the beginning, and it's very interwoven, and it's very clear that they're writing this story as a two-part story at the same time. And I think it elevates the episode that it has all of this intertwined.
Yeah, the two parts fit together really well. Everything makes sense. The first part, If this was done by two different writers, you would never have had the aspect of setting it up with the shipyard and the bits and pieces of the Vulcan ships and things like that.
But of course,
nobody,
that's not to
nobody
say...
would have had that foresight. But in this case, it was a case of what the two parts fit together properly. But it's also, I think it breaks in a nice place. So the first part is all about getting to find out what Spock's up to, and this part is all about this is what Spock's up to. Actually, he's not this defector, but he's actually got a plan, which sounds like an ambitious, if worthwhile, plan.
Yes, absolutely. And I was going to just point out that, you know, that's not to say that this is just one long episode. There are clear divide lines throughout. There's a clear shift as it now becomes, you know, Ambassador Spock's story rather than a story that happens to be about a journey to get to Ambassador Spock. And actually, an episode that this really reminds me of, and I don't know if you guys would have, you have it on your memory, but in the second season of the S9, they opened with The Homecoming, The Circle, and The Siege. Mm-hmm. And I always loved that little trilogy of episodes. And in a very similar way, it was like a three-parter that was, it was clearly written at the same time. It was very intertwined, but each of the episodes themselves kind of stood alone with their own flavor. In the first case of, you know, going out to rescue the guy, then the political fallout, and then the, you know, obviously they had the siege of the station and, you know, getting back control. And I kind of feel that this episode is, I'll rephrase it. I think that that episode is, owes a lot to kind of the success of the structure of things like Unification that they had done previously.
Okay. So, what are you doing on Romulus? Gee, I was planning to ask you that question myself, Dr. Spock. Mr. Spock. One is his name, the other is not. Okay, so Spock is on Romulus. He finds about this growing movement of Romulans who would like to learn about the Vulcan way. So Spock says he's here to open a Vulcan brothel here on Romulus. I'm sorry. Sorry, I couldn't help that. Spock is either here trying to reunite two people. I have to ask, is that wise? I mean, here's the deal. And what I mean, and I wrote these notes 2 weeks ago, so that's why I'm sitting there going, what do I mean by that? But here's what I mean by that. Is it wise to reunite the two people? Because does that mean the Romulans are going to become the good guys? Or the Vulcans will join with them and become the bad guys?
I'm sure Spock hopes they become the good guys.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he's... Spock isn't going over to Romulus to make sure that they've got, you know, a decent gambling strip and some nice hotels for the Vulcans to come over and party. So I assume it's kind of, you know, it's the story of the errant child coming back into the family.
But would that be the Federation's concern, though? Would it make sense that if these two powers unite, where will Vulcan land when the Cold War with the Federation continues?
I think the ultimate hope is that it doesn't continue, that the Romulans work within the Federation effectively. Because what Spock says is right, and this whole mission isn't really a concern of Starfleet from that perspective. It's an internal affairs issue for Vulcan within the Federation. But ultimately, it does have that knock-on effect. And I would also disagree with Spock when he says that this is his mission and it's no concern of Starfleet, because although from a Vulcan perspective he's right, you're still Spock. you've got the Starfleet history, you've got the history within the Federation, you're Ambassador Spock, having taken over from your father. So there's definitely, that is of concern for that reason from Starfleet.
Okay. Then help me with this one here. Here's another thing. Spock says to Picard, in your own way, you're as stubborn as another captain of the Enterprise I once knew. Now, Picard then says, then I'm in good company, sir. And I'm curious what that means. What does that mean, I'm in good company, sir? Because I really don't know what he means by that.
I think he's taking it as a compliment. I don't think there's anything. I don't think there's anything more than that. My question would actually be, I wonder what Captain of the Enterprise is referring to, because Pike was quite stubborn as well.
Yeah, but he's obviously not.
The implication is it's Kirk. Yeah, but yes. I would suggest it's Pike.
Who was the Enterprise B guy? Harriman.
Harriman.
So you think, yeah, I wanted to... Perhaps he's referring to Harriman. Maybe, you know, because Spock famously is not on the launch of the Enterprise B, and clearly Spock probably had received like 50 or 60 emails from Harriman saying, please turn up, please turn up, please turn up. He's basically saying, Picard, you're as stubborn as that fool Harriman that kept on pestering me to turn up to his launch party.
I don't know. Rachel Garrett could have been stubborn too.
I mean, actually, this is one thing I don't like too much. I don't like when they're obviously trying to call out things that are not, you know, things that the viewer would have more of a connection to than the in-world universe. And what I mean by that is that, you know, him saying, oh, you know, you remember of another captain, eh? 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 He's basically saying Captain Kirk. And from our perspective, we think, hey, Kirk, hey, there's a film about Kirk that's coming out in a month's time, and isn't that great? He must be referring to Kirk. And but from an in-universe perspective, he's thinking, oh, this guy I knew 90 years ago that died 85 years ago. Now, why would, in a way, I would actually prefer Picard not even to know who Kirk is, or at least not to fetishize about this character called Kirk that lived 100 years ago. I mean, you know, Lou, in your current job, do you know who did your job 100 years ago? I mean, I don't. I'm not even sure who the Prime Minister would have been 100 years ago from now. It's not, you know, I like the idea of, although there are big, great players in history, I like the idea that the in-world universe has a chance to be a little bit more filled out than just the, you know, one or two people that we happen to know as viewers. Yeah. And I think they kind of go against this here.
There's two instances of it in this scene. There's the one we're talking about where he says that Picard's as stubborn as another captain in Enterprise. And I think that, on that case, I would agree with you, but it is a bit... it's a bit of a stretch to say that's an in-universe thing. The other reference is the one that is the direct call to Star Trek VI, the promotional part, where Spock basically calls out the fact that he still feels guilty, even though it's 80 years later, the fact he involved Captain Kirk in the whole Kittimer aspect and trying to get the Klingons piece together. So this time, he's trying to do things himself so that he doesn't have that guilt and doesn't have to deal with everybody else being involved, because that's not his place to get them involved. And I think that works quite well, because that is an in-universe thing. It's Spock calling in his own experiences and saying, I made this mistake 80 years ago, I'm not going to make it again.
Okay, yes-ish, because let me just also put out some other things that Spock's done. I mean, Spock was responsible for V'ger, right? He got the crew into their position because he was the one that was going out to seek them, and he ended up on the Enterprise as well. So, okay, maybe he didn't get them into the trouble, but he was certainly present and was put them in harm's way. In obviously, Cirque for Spock, it's entirely around the fact that Spock is the guy that's having, you know, they're going after to save him, and he implicitly has put them in danger again. So I think there are other cases where he has, either through action or through, you know, wanting to be saved, has placed the ship in danger. So although it works with Star Trek VI, it probably works with, you know, 5, 4, and 1 as well. And that's why I think it's a little bit odd to call it out.
Okay. I think it fits best for Star Trek VI, because it's such a big power he's getting involved with.
No, I think that's
the Klingons. In this case, it's the Romulans.
I do concede that, and I do think that it's most applicable there. And it obviously is the better call out, right? You know, saying that, hey, you're as stubborn as another captain I knew. He might as well have said, you know, you've got lush, thick hair like another captain I knew. It's kind of, it's not what you would think of in universe, I don't think, from Picard's perspective. No.
Okay. So why do you think that no one on Romulus is curious about this Vulcan walking around?
Okay, can I ask a question? Because this is something that always bugs me. Are Romulans and Vulcans, are they supposed to look the same?
No.
Because obviously there's additional ridges, but also at the same time we know that it's, what, like 500 years ago when the split occurred, or is it further back than that? And if it's only 500 years ago, have they been really desperately inbreeding that has caused these ridges to come out? what's up with the ridges? And then by the time you get to JJ verse, no ridges again. It makes my little kind of, you know, internal consistency check get all confused. And obviously with Bands of Terror, no ridges. So
The in-universe change for Klingons was at least eventually explained away in Enterprise, but the change for Romulans, just because they had a bigger makeup budget, it's never really sat well with that one for me. So,
So there's actually a part of me that can believe that a Romulan can go and pass himself off as a Vulcan and vice versa.
Yes, I'd agree.
That's generally how I like read it.
Well, because here's the thing. I wondered, Simon Tarsis, he was found out to be half Romulan, half human. So why didn't he have any ridges? He just had the ears.
Maybe like Romulus is really, really hot and the ridges just come out when they're in a very, very hot climate. That would work. Well, then, hang on, Vulcan's very, very hot, right? So maybe they're like the sweat pores that sweat away when it's very hot.
The real question is, what's a Reman? Because you've got the pointy ears.
Yeah, but I've always... No, that I think that's coincidental. I've always assumed that the Remans would just happen to be the poor sods that were there when the Romulans / Vulcans arrived. And then they went, okay, we'll take these dudes. They look, they seem to have broad shoulders and a can-do attitude. Get them down the caves. that's what I assumed happened.
Okay. Well, anyway. So I thought, why... nobody said anything about the Vulcan walking around. But then Pardak does announce that the proconsul of the Romulan Senate wants to meet with Spock. He's very interested in unification. Isn't that great?
It's a little too convenient.
Way too convenient.
I bought this guy. I thought this guy was like young, idealistic kind of politician. I thought he could have been believed.
Yeah, I think from that perspective, yeah. I mean, it does kind of... I don't think it explicitly mentions it in this episode, but the implication is it's the young that are open-minded and more interested in what ignoring the propaganda that goes along with... Well, the older you get, the more closed-minded you become, and then so you think the Romulans and the Federation as a whole are this bad thing that the Romulans should keep away from. But the young are saying, well, I want to learn more about these Vulcans and their culture and where the Romulans came from in the first place. So the idea that this is a young proconsul kind of fits into that same model. So, it's believable.
Okay. Fascinating. So meanwhile, Riker visits a strip club on Quaalar 2 to visit the piano girl with forearms and wants to speak with her about her husband. Which one? The dead one, I'm afraid. I'm afraid.
Doesn't Riker kind of completely slip in to this particular this particular club? I mean, I'd be surprised if he hadn't been there before.
Yeah, it's very sleazy, this one. It's not a nice place. I mean, you get the smoking suggestion without actually smoking. Was it salt she was sucking on?
Salt.
A filthy habit. Yeah.
Yeah. Salt. Oh, I never liked it. Ugh, that's good. Bad habit.
Do you think it's a vape version these days?
I mean, can you imagine that? That salt sticks on your... Oh, can't imagine it.
Did you notice the piano player sounded remarkably like Deep Space Nine's computer? This is because although the actress was it Harriet Leader, I think I said, the voice is actually Judy Duran that does the computer voice for Deep Space Nine.
Really?
I see, now that you mention it, that seems to fit. Okay, I never knew that.
I didn't know for certain until I looked it up in Memory Alpha, but when I was listening to her, I thought she sounded remarkably like that computer. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, she's an uncredited co-star. Judy M. Durand is Amory's voice. Mm. And what we're talking about, people who turn up in Star Trek elsewhere, did you know that Pardek was in Spock's very first appearance as well? He was that Malachi Throne did the voice of the Keeper in The Cage. and actually also played Commodore Mendez in The Menagerie.
Is that right?
Yeah. That is according to the Memory Alpha.
Wow. I never knew that. No, I'm actually just looking at it. Oh, he passed away. Wow, that's... I mean, I like it when you have... In particular, when you have the crossover between the original series and then the, you know, the TNG era. I always love that. Like, you know, the guy from The Way to Eden and ends up in... Little Green Men, and obviously Dynamo Dow moves across as well. I always love them because they're so completely unrecognizable, right? And it was a completely different business, 20 years prior. I wonder whether or not we're going to have a similar thing with Discovery, where we are beyond 25 years after TNG and DS9 were airing.
Yeah.
And we're in a world, right, where you can take, whatever these, young, attractive ladies that turn up in TNG, and they'll be, they'll be old women now. You can see these child actors and they'll be in their, mid-30s. It's going to be interesting to see if there's any crossovers between the TNG and, the relaunch era. Mm.
Interesting. Maybe Sela
maybe
come
Molly
back.
Will come back.
Hmm? Molly or Sela.
Yeah.
Or maybe they can go back and save Tasha.
I would love to see Sela involved more, because there's one disappointing aspect of this episode. It's her last appearance.
Actually, so should we have a quick... Where do people sit on Sela? Because I think she's absolutely wonderful and fantastic, and I love her throughout this episode. And mm-hmm. I think that the general consensus is that she's dreadful. And I can't feel bad about having Denise Crosby as the blonde wigged Romulan. I think she's great.
As do I. I'm an apologist for Sela. I do get the same impression that she's not a white character, but I think the whole concept's fantastic. Idea that Tasha was killed off, but then an alternate Tasha was sent back in time and captured by the Romulans and had a child who then kind of betrayed her and became this villain of the week, effectively. And it's disappointing that she only turns up in Redemption and this. I know she's in the Shadows as well in an earlier episode, but effectively the only time she has any effect is Redemption 2 and Unification 2.
Mm-hmm. And I agree. I like having her on. I think she was pretty awesome as a badass Romulan.
And I think the way that she plays with Picard, the way that she kind of interacts with Picard, perhaps is a better way of phrasing it, and also in particular Data in this episode. I think that she has, she has the how to behave well in Trek down. She knows how to do that. Whereas some of the guest characters, we'll have great guest characters come in and we'll have less great guest characters come in. But I think that Denise Crosby knows exactly what's expected. And yeah, sure, it's a pantomime villain, right? But there are occasions when you need pantomime villains. And there are occasions when you need, crazy Q to turn up. And there are occasions where you need someone more like, Golmasep to turn up. There are different stories need different types of threat. And I think what is asked of her, she delivers very well.
The only disappointing aspect of her appearance in this episode is it comes so very quickly after we get, he's a young proconsul, he might actually be up for unification. And then almost literally the next scene, she turns up and goes, this is what's going to happen. So you already know that unification's off the table.
Yeah, I agree. They don't, I think from the Romulan side, they very quickly get to a phase where that they're they're trying to avoid a trap. And it would have been nicer to have more than one side on the Romulus front. So maybe knowing that there's a movement, have the movement being stronger and having it to outsmart the establishment without it being so clear that they're not particularly powerful and they're being led into the trap.
The interesting thing is the Pro Council is very hands off in this episode. It's like he's there and he's obviously aware of what Sela's doing, but anything that Sela actually actively does, he's out of the scene.
They don't want us to know he's involved just yet.
Yeah, and I think it works out quite well for him because his name's Naral, and when you come into the later seasons of Deep Space Nine, the Praetor of Romulus is called Naral, so the implication is it's the same guy.
True. Although, actually, I have to say, I've been critical of the TNG before, whereby the you fly up to a planet and you hail down to the planet, and basically the prime minister or the president of the planet says, "Hey, how are you doing?" And he's the guy that picks up the phone, and he's the guy that you go and visit. And then when there's like a devious plan, he's the guy that's implicated in every single aspect of it. And I think they had this with, which is the planet with the. Is it Angel One, the one with the Amazonian women?
Yeah.
There was the one where effectively the leader of the planet was going to sit there and execute prisoners in her office. I mean, as if they don't have a better way of executing prisoners than have it done in the office. So I like the, I've criticized it in the past, and I think it's very realistic, right? That the politician wouldn't be involved in.
Yeah.
Every single aspect, and to the extent that there's a relatively high ranking guy that's going to take over and carry out orders, that's pretty good. Now the thing about Naral though in this episode versus what he gets shown as in the S9, he does age a lot, and it's not the same actor, but there is a possibility that it's the same the same individual.
All right, so Riker goes to meet with this four-armed lady and wants to talk about her dead husband, the one he killed, no less. And she suggests he comes back in a couple days to meet with a fat Ferengi who might have information he needs. Oh, and you better bring some napkins, too.
Okay, let me, because we're going back now. Riker doesn't really know how to play piano. And he doesn't know how to play piano well enough to be able to use that as a bargaining chip. I'll just put that out there.
Well, she likes him, nonetheless. And he seems to like her, because, later on, when that fat Ferengi shows up and Worf calls back to the ship, he goes, hey, is that hot? Is that hot four-armed female that I talked to last week? Well, he seems to like her. I'm on my way!
I love the way that the keyboard player ends up playing the Klingon song, right? I can't remember the name of it. And then, Worf sits there and he starts mumbling to himself. No. That's great.
Like, Actu Melota?
Yes.
No, please no. If there's one thing I do not like in Star Trek, it's when the Klingons start singing.
Oh, no. It's not aesthetically good or anything like that. But the fact that it allows the Ferengi to enter and say, what? I don't quite know what the quote is, but he basically shouts down at Worf having his music being played. And then he puts on...
It makes me sympathise with the Ferengi. That's the thing. I don't particularly want to sympathise with this Ferengi, but in this case, he's absolutely right. Stop singing, Worf.
It's like what is fat that dreadful Klingon noise? That's on.
Is it? There's like two episodes of Deep Space Nine. There's a Klingon on the promenade singing. Is it Klingon chef or something?
Oh yes.
One of those episodes is Melora, because I was on Upper Pylon 2 for that episode, and it was the worst part of the worst episode.
Melora's a fine episode.
I love Klingon chef.
It has the bit in it where.
What, Melora? That is.
Yeah, with the Klingon chef, that's the one where do they have the scene there where they said, oh, you've hardly eaten your gah, and said, well, you've just moved it around it. And actually, no, I didn't move it. It moved itself. Actually, thinking about that, that's not Melora. That's the other one. Nope. That's when the Trill people come and check in on Dax to make sure she's okay.
Yes.
Playing God? I'm thinking it's playing God.
I think where Jadzia is trying to check out her own initiate, I think that's plain God.
Yeah. That's it.
But you like Melora?
I never said that.
Oh. I thought you said there's nothing wrong with Melora.
There's actually a fair amount wrong, but...
Yeah.
It's a little bit of a guilty pleasure.
Okay, so we had mentioned... Just a second here. We had mentioned that the Proconsul Nerol, he's whole hog, ready to go unification and bring these two back together. So do you think at the time, not knowing what we know 25 years later, but watching this straight on at the time, do you think we're going, I believe this guy. He's like, we're going to redo something that you and I have never seen before in our lifetime. Because, well, the young people are tired of it. Neither I conform to their ways or they'll boot me out of office. I believed him. I fell for it at the time. You guys?
I thought it was possible, but he was always going to struggle with the older ones that are set in their ways.
But you've got this young new politician who's got fresh ideas because the young people are getting sick of the old ways. It made sense to me.
No, I kind of bought into him. I didn't know whether or not he would be able to be successful just because the system would be against him. But certainly at the beginning, I was not. When you have the storyline and you potentially show that they cautiously welcome his positioning, I don't look at the Spock character or Picard and think, you're a fool. Why are you believing this nonsense? You're being, it's clearly you're being led on. So from that perspective, I think the position of the leader is good in my mind.
Mm-hmm. At least I started to fall for it until Spock walks out of the room and Sela walks in. Oh, there goes that.
Yeah, that but happens too quickly for me to really buy it.
And I think, Spock's still very skeptical as to what's really happening, but we'll play along. So what do you think of the bit between Spock and Data? As you look back on your life, do you ever miss your humanity? Or as Spock says, I have no regrets.
I thought this was a very odd conversation because if there's one thing that Spock clearly learns in his time throughout the history of Star Trek, it's that his humanity is something that he can benefit from and not something to be hidden away. We mentioned V'ger earlier. That's pretty much the point where he realises I can't go total logic. I have to stick with my human side because this is what V'ger lacks. So you would have thought Spock at this point would be able to impart that kind of information onto Data and say, you know what, you're right, keep pursuing what you're doing with this, trying to get some sort of humanity as much as possible, because you will learn other things that you can't, that logic doesn't do.
Well, yeah, but, the V'ger thing happened before he died and came back to life. His Katra, so maybe he lost a lot of his humanity. Nah, it's just a reboot. He just rebooted.
Nah, I liked him better before he died.
Yeah, that's what Bone says, I believe.
Yep.
Okay. Let's see here. So what do you think about the Ferengi? The fat Ferengi. I thought he was hilarious. Hypothetically speaking, I don't know. I never learned to speak hypothetical. I mean, he was obviously being a smartass all the way up to where he got that fish shoved in his face.
that was a really good scene, actually. I did like the Ferengi's happy-go-lucky attitude, but I did like the way Riker handled them as well. Literally handled them. And then put a napkin in him anyway.
Yeah, he got that napkin, yeah.
Yeah, I never quite... How does how do these Ferengi, not just this one, but others, how do they maintain kind of the women on their arms at a moment's notice? I never quite understood that. I mean, these guys must be, I suppose, the only guys dripping with platinum, right? Yeah. But yeah, I just it's a strange one. I do like the Ferengi. I do like the portrayal, but it's always seems odd to me that there are, you know, the women are always at their on their arms.
Maybe those Umaks give something for the women too.
Yeah, platinum. They're not the greatest of female minds in the universe, I don't think.
Okay. Well, like I said, you know, Riker shoved food in his face, but he was nice enough to give him an extra napkin.
There you go, bud.
So Picard discovers a small message that the Pearl Council sent out. 1400. And I think, you know, obviously that's where Spock said, yeah, this is all bull. He had to set up a meeting with the Pearl Council to announce the peace talks at 1400 hours. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Those Romulans, they're sneaky guys, aren't they?
Very sneaky.
Very sneaky. Very cheeky. Cheeky.
Spock seems very, very certain of this. I'm not entirely sure that I would have been so certain. But then again, I'm not Spock, so...
It could be a coincidence.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it has something to do with the stolen Vulcan ship. Or, as we find out, the three stolen Vulcan ships.
Actually, I like that. I like the fact that there's more going on than we know about. Because sometimes people get a little bit lazy and the only thing that they've done happens to be found by the Enterprise. I like the idea, and when they explicitly mention, no, we've stolen three ships, you've only found one. You know, give us a bit more credit than that.
Yeah.
I think that's a nice touch. It makes the story feel more real.
All right. Right. Okay. And of course, there's a rat in the fold. It turns out Pardak, he was the double agent luring Spock to Romulus. But he did his service to the Romulan people.
Yeah, okay, thanks.
Okay. This is about I don't particularly like. It's like 80 years of friendship between Pardak and Spock, and he throws it away with no explanation whatsoever. It's just, yeah, you did your service for the Romulan people. Why? The how of how they get to this is logical, but the why that just doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. There is no good reason for Bardick to do this. I wish he'd given some explanation for it. Unless he'd literally had spent 80 years winding Spock up to this point.
He took 80 years to get Spock there.
That's playing a long game.
Yeah. That is one long undercover mission. All right. Well, anyway, so the whole plan is to turn the whole thing around, and it's not unification, it's the Romulan conquest of Vulcan.
Which is, you know, unification of a sort, I suppose.
Yeah, just take another turn. And I love the part with the Data and Sela. You know, here, I'm just writing something. I don't ever get to write. It's one of the things I miss not being able to do in this job. Well, perhaps you'd be better in another job.
I had completely forgotten that line until I rewatched, and I laughed out loud with that. And it's a sign of how comfortable Denise Crosby and Brent Spiner are playing off each other. That interaction comes across so natural and so smooth. And then the look that she gives him afterwards, it's like, it's wonderful. I really like it.
Too bad they couldn't have tossed another line in and says, so, I hear you're fully functional. Well, anyway. And then, just completely throw him under.
Riker strikes me as being the one. Yeah. Riker strikes me as being the one that would do the mother-daughter thing.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, wouldn't it have been funny if Data actually found a way to both Tasha and her daughter. Anyway.
Again, that's never appropriate, even with you know, even with time, temporal mechanics stuff in play.
I still would have loved to have had her say, so I hear you're fully functional, huh?
Okay, what can make that worse than her maybe saying, I hear mum told me that you're fully functional.
Yeah, she was a baby when her mother got killed. That's really creepy.
Mum says if I ever meet you, that I'm supposed to meet you. So Sela decides to send the ships on their journey. And but although she did show that holographic Spock, you know, by now, Federation sensors are detecting 3 Vulcan ships. These carry the future of the Romulan and Vulcan people. Okay, this is what we're going to do, guys. Okay? We would rather have a Spock that could answer questions, but whatever. You're not going to play along. We're just going to use him. So why don't you guys sit here, have a little Romulan ale. We're going to leave the room now and put all this plan into motion. Don't you go nowhere. And they all walk out. How stupid do these people have to be? They don't put one guard in there. Keep one guard.
I'm assuming Sela has never seen James Bond. Because this is Bond villain 101, this.
Yes. I mean, why would you leave all the technology in that room for them to escape? Or try to escape, or do whatever it is they did? I thought that was pretty stupid, actually. It's like when you're confronted with 3 guys, they're gonna kick your ass by using kung fu or some kind of martial arts. They don't all attack at one time. No, they all dance around while one of them attacks you. The others 2 will dance around menacingly till you knock them out 1 by 1. So why would they just leave them in this room? She does need another job. I will say that much. Okay, so the Enterprise detects the 3 ships and heads toward them. Good job, Riker. Both he and the Holo-Riker, that is. What do you think of... do you think Data really would have gotten Riker's hair wrong?
No.
No.
I mean, how can he get it wrong? I mean, at the same time, we're expected to believe he can program him so that his size, all the features on his face, his beard, everything is absolutely correct, except that he combed his hair in a little bit of a weird way. It makes no sense. I have to say, I actually thought the story was pretty well... this scene was pretty well executed, because I remember originally watching and thinking, oh, Riker's got there. I didn't see the hologram thing come in. But then when I watched it again today, I kind of thought, well, when Riker turns up, he turns up immediately. No one tries to fire at him. And they kind of jump behind. Well, one of them jumps behind and then another people just pull out their guns. And then when they end up shooting, first of all, they shoot them in the chest rather than the head. Perhaps you shouldn't be looking for a headshot on TNG. But the third guard, Riker gets hit, the security officer gets hit, and then the extra security officer gets hit like a second and a half later. And I would have expected a little bit better training on the Romulan side.
Yeah.
So they wait too long to shoot them.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, of course, that's the way they do it.
Yeah, there's that whole, I will protect myself first and then shoot. Whereas you would think the action should be to shoot first.
So when Sela says, yeah, we expect the Enterprise to start moving in which case we're going to give them more important things to worry about, I didn't think it was something as goofy as we have a medical crisis on some other planet that's the other way around the galaxy, not nowhere near where we're going. I always thought they were going to, you know, hit them with a couple of warbirds. You know, just come out of nowhere. We're going to give the Enterprise something to worry about. again, it would have been better to have a couple warbirds decloak and just start beating the crap out of the Enterprise instead of them trying to lure the Enterprise away.
Well, no? Riker certainly didn't buy the coded message from Picard. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there was clearly that cloaked warbird around, but it never really seemed up for a fight.
And it's another thing, they say, you know, it did use a captain's, I don't know, maybe something that negotiations are going well, stay where you are, we'll keep advised. Because even Riker says, yeah, I'll bet it did. I don't think Riker was too impressed with it.
Yeah, Riker wasn't falling for anything, because even when Crusher turned up and went, there's a medical emergency, we have to go now, and he was like, nah. Don't believe it.
Yeah, let's verify that first.
Yeah, you'd think Crusher would have verified it herself before taking it to the effective captain of the ship at the time.
Right. Yep, let's verify it first. But they didn't have to worry about verifying because Spock is making his announcement. And everything goes as planned until he changes the script a little. These ships carry a Romulan invasion force and must be stopped. Yeah.
Yep. Did Spock really have to troll the viewer, right? So the viewer knows what the original message is. So why has he put in another message which is identical to the original message, but just has a twist halfway through?
It's ingenious. Because these people are expecting, they know that that hologram said these words in this particular order, and he's saying those exact words in that particular order until the punchline. And none of them knew that the wrong information was going out.
Okay, sure, but I see it as the message being sent out. They probably have, you know, 5 seconds from the moment they realize the message is wrong. So you can either use those 5 seconds from at the beginning, or you can play around and pretend that you've got the right message, and then have those 5 seconds at the end. I don't think that reassuring the Romulans gives you like a greater lead time on the message. Maybe it does. Maybe for a couple of seconds or so.
Yeah, maybe if they give it the same start, then it catches them off guard because they think, yeah, that message is playing as I would expect, and they don't pay as much attention.
Yeah, it's exactly what they expected, all the way up until you said the wrong thing. But here's another thing.
I would have preferred the message to come on straight away and there to be like a naked Spock screaming, "We're all gonna die!" you wouldn't need that long a message.
No, but I don't know. Like I said, it makes perfect sense that he would say the exact same script all the way up to the point, to the punchline, as I call it. But here's another thing. Broadcast stations always have a delay just in case something slips in that isn't supposed to be there. They usually are on a 5 or 10 second delay. I don't know if you guys ever call up your radio station over there and, you know, if you, like a game they put in, if you can give us if the fifth caller can give us the name of Spock's beautician, you'll win this. And then, you know, they put people on live on the radio. Well, somebody might say the wrong damn word, and they have to try and bleep that out real quick. Well, by having that pause, they're able to stop it before it ever goes out. Why couldn't the Romulans have done that?
Maybe Romulans don't swear, so they don't have that facility. I don't know.
Yeah. They're stupid. It's almost like the Romulans were watching, you know, The three Vulcan ships. These ships carry a Romulan invasion force. What did he just say? Did he say Romulan invasion force? Yeah. Did he just
rewind.
Say Romulan invasion? Wait a minute. Damn it! He did say Romulan force. Cut the feed. Well, it's too late. So anyway, what did he just say? All right. But the Enterprise catches up with the Vulcan ships and is about ready to take 2,000 Romulan prisoners of war home with them, except for that warbird that doesn't beam them aboard. They just pick them off one by one. That had to suck, wouldn't it?
2,000 troops, was that going to be enough to occupy the whole of Vulcan?
Well, no, I don't think it could have been enough to occupy the whole of Vulcan. But then you also have to ask the question that if you're going to send a warbird alongside, then why do you have your troops in the non-warbird vessels? And then you can say, well, you had troops in the warbird, and you also had these other 2,000. But then that just begs the question that send two warbirds. And maybe they had two warbirds. By that point, well, then send three. There's no reason for you to...
Give an entire fleet of warbirds.
Yeah, you could have had 10 of them there.
You could have had a lot of warbirds. At which point, if you're going to have a lot of warbirds, why even have this game in the first place? Just invade. Especially considering they've got a cloaking device. So as a Romulan, when they mention that all we need to do is keep people off guard until we land on Vulcan and we occupy the place with 2,000 troops, couldn't they kind of do that with a cloaked ship or two?
Yeah, but maybe the idea is that with the 2,000 troops, they were going to be invited into the kind of inner sanctum of Vulcan, whereas if it turned up with the troops, you'd have to fight their way on.
But then that's basically saying, like, you know how in the olden days you would have like an ambassador from France being sent over to Spain or whatever, and he'll ride over on horseback and he'll say, oh, you know, please let me come and talk to your king and so on. I say, okay, who have you got with you? Oh, it's just me and these 2,000 troops. it's a bit of a, it's literally a Trojan horse here, right?
Yeah, it's out of a Trojan horse.
Well, yeah, but I think they were hoping the Vulcan people would see three Vulcan ships and go, well, they're Vulcan people. They're Romulans and Vulcans, they really have done something good. And now if they came in three pack-led ships, it might be a problem.
But is this relying on the age-old Vulcan? Are you here relying on Vulcans to be very, very naive? I don't think they're particularly known for naivety or for their, you know, for their gullibility. I think the Romulans are relying on too much gullibility here from a race of, logicians.
Okay, so the reunification thing didn't quite happen the way anybody anticipated, so it's now time to leave. And Picard and Data are able to leave, but Spock's he announces he's going to remain.
This was a very strange decision. I mean, for one thing, Spock and Data and Picard had to escape from what should be a very secure building, and they seem to have no trouble whatsoever. Now, I know Data managed to do the finger thing with Sela. No, I'll rephrase that. Data managed to do the neck pinch with Sela. So that helped.
He did the finger thing with Yar, remember?
Yeah, that was it. It was the mother-daughter thing from earlier. So, yeah, but I'd imagine they didn't spend the entire time leaving that building giving people neck pinches. Mm-hmm. So, at some point, somebody must have turned up with weapons to stop. No? Is it that easy to get out of that building?
Yeah, and this building, isn't it like the equivalent of like the White House or something?
Yeah.
This is supposed to be the center of
the Capitol building. Maybe.
The Capitol building. It would be a surprise if they managed just to walk out. And again...
Yeah.
Two guards coming in, and you know, two useless guards at that. And she's only a sub-commander, right? Cedar's only a sub-commander?
Yeah.
It always seems weird.
I mean, where's Spock going to live? I know they said Pardak didn't know about these caves, but what's he going to do there?
He's going to spend his life living in caves. He seems to spend a lot of time in caves, actually. Because when we meet him in Star Trek 09, he's in a cave. He seems to get his retraining in Star Trek 4 in a cave. We meet him in this, and he's pretty much in a cave all the time.
Do you think maybe this might be a remember? They're just planting this kind of seed to see maybe if something springs up later on? Because he never comes out of Vulcan, except unless they somehow knew about the JJ movie. Because the JJ movie, he leaves Vulcan, and when he leaves Vulcan, he screws everything up. Or, no, he leaves Romulus and screws everything up. I mean, I don't understand why he would have left there unless there was some... stayed there unless there was something that could have happened in the future but didn't.
Yeah, this is the depressing sort of epilogue of this episode, in that Spock stays on Romulus because he thinks the kids are the future, and okay, so he might not get unification in his lifetime, but unification is kind of likely to happen further down the line, except it won't, because in 20 years' time, a supernova is going to destroy Romulus. Now, Spock is going to do his best to try and save them, but he won't make it. And he'll then get thrown back in time and create a new Kelvin timeline universe. Mm-hmm. So all these kids that are the future probably get killed.
But I do like that.
That's not great. But one thing I didn't quite get, though, is that so Spock's going to be living on Romulus for the foreseeable future. Spock's going to be sitting there trying to effectively destabilize the political situation and be an enemy of the state. I mean, if the Romulans can run anything properly, why isn't he executed within the next, like, 48 hours? You would imagine they are quite efficient at this kind of stuff. And not only does he not get caught during this period, but then we have the Dominion War as well. And I'm sure they had to clamp down on dissent during the Dominion War as they were losing, you know, hundreds of thousands of troops. And then somehow at the back end of that, with the Riemann situation, he still hangs around, I suppose. And then at the end of that one, he's the person has to save Romulus from this big explosion. It you know, yes, he's on Romulus, but he's not going to be the most favored person in the world. He's going to be he's going to be a dissident.
He does seem to survive a lot for a fugitive.
Yeah.
And even staying in this point of time is a risk, because he's just escaped from that building and he's just ruined their plans, and he must be a fugitive even then. But, I mean, if he was on Romulus to begin with and it was kind of tolerated, because obviously they was getting on with the Pro-Council and there was people that were quite happy to have him there, or at least they were, well, they had a plan, that goes away after this incident. He's from this point forth, he's a wanted man.
All right, but I do like the touching moment between Picard and Spock at the end, when Spock gets to preview what his dad shared.
I don't like it.
I don't?
I don't think it's Picard's gift to give up. So if, let's say, you know...
No, you're wrong. It is because... because... He says to Sarek, I know he's caused you pain, but I know you love him. And he says, tell him, Picard. And I think this is what he's doing in this mind meld, is telling what his father said.
Yeah, because he makes the point earlier in this episode that, like, Sarek loved you, Spock. And Spock's reaction is kind of, yeah, that's Bendai syndrome for you. And it's like, no, there's this... ridiculous belief that Vulcans don't have emotions. Well, they do. They have emotions. They just repress them. And I think it's quite nice that they revisit that in 09, because after Amanda gets killed, when Vulcan gets destroyed, Sarek openly admits that you once asked me why I married your mother. It's because I loved her. And I like that. I quite like that bit of the Kelvin timeline, Sarek. So. To then hear that in this episode that Sarek obviously loved his son, and that was deep down. Okay, so Spock might deny it, but with a mind meld, he'll get to feel what his father felt.
Right. Yes, because all through the episode, he kept saying, you know, he loves you. You know, your father loved you. Yeah, that was just that illness that he was going through. No, I think it was fitting that he actually was able to touch whatever Sarek shared.
Okay, there's a part of me that appreciates the story that Spock and his father didn't have the time to kind of reconcile and to kind of, you know, make good on their relationship. And I just feel that basically it's almost, I know it's not exactly the same thing, but it's almost as if, you know, after your dad died, then someone pops around and said, hey, you didn't get along with your dad, but I used to go drinking with him a lot, and I have some stories, and he probably thought you were a great guy. And I know it's not on the same level, but I feel that it's a very cheap get out of... It fixes the past, whereas I actually think that, you know, Spock should live with the consequences of having been a pain in the backside to his dad.
okay. Huh? You can... I don't know. No. No. Because now he's able to see why, what he missed.
I think in most cases, when a father and son disagree, then they either reconcile somewhere down the line or they don't. But there's no once as usually happens, the son outlives the father, any opportunity to reconcile otherwise goes away. In this case, there's a get out that the Vulcans have a third option where they can the father might have gone, but here's some remnant of what he was before, so maybe you'll understand your father more through this mind meld than you ever did through words. Because is it this episode they mentioned that Sarek and Spock chose never to mind meld?
Yes, they did.
Yeah.
They never chose to. Here's another question that I was just thinking, just now popped in my head. Do you think Sarek had a chance to do the remember thing before he died?
That's a good question. I wonder if that would have had a knock-on effect because he had obviously had a debilitating mental illness. If he'd done that, would the Bendai syndrome have transferred in some way? I know it doesn't transfer to Picard, so, but then Picard's not Vulcan, so maybe that's a different issue entirely. So maybe remember doesn't work if your faculties are failing.
I mean, I'm not entirely sure how the remember thing works in general. I mean, does someone pop around to Sarek every fortnight or so and gets a bit of a remember download, and he effectively uses it as a backup?
Backup strategy.
and so what's supposed to actually happen with the remember anyway?
Exactly, so that's a good point.
Look, I mean, I obviously know that in Search for Spock we happen to have a free body that they happen to find that had grown out of the grass. So, you know, that's quite an exceptional circumstance. But in general, what do they expect it to do?
The only other time it comes up is season 4 of Enterprise when, like, at one point, Archer has a catheter of Surak. And people seem to be carrying that in their head. So I never understand if it's supposed to go anywhere. They also refer to the Catric Arc in 09? As if maybe that's somewhere they store the downloads.
Oh, no, hell, don't they have to go to that place in Enterprise to... Isn't there like a hall of memories where they put these things into a bucket? Now, that's going to sound really crazy, but...
That's my impression. It's like kind of they upload it to the cloud.
Yeah, upload it to the cloud, but the cloud's made out of terracotta.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to have to do Enterprise at some point, Lou.
Oh, yeah? Huh. That's got to be after Lower Pylon 3. How about there's coffee in that nebula? Or just, you know, you're listening to the coffee in the nebula. No, that doesn't make any sense. But then we go to Enterprise. You're listening to Porthos's doghouse.
That's a great episode name.
Yeah, I even have little sound effects as we open up the show. So, I don't know.
Lou, we've really got it down as being girl on girl on man on dog. I don't know why you're changing the name of our podcast.
I forgot about that. Okay, I don't know that. Let's see. You're listening to girl on girl on man on dog. Nah. Or what was that thing
you think it's
called?
Already taken?
It could be.
It may be
no,
taken,
I'm not doing a Google search. I can't do a Google search called girl on girl on man on dog. That can't come up good. Anyway, what was that thing that they go into? What is that they go into whenever they come back from a away mission? They go into this chamber and they get rid of their biohazard where they gel up each other. What is that called? Decontamination?
Decontamination, yeah.
Didn't they call that the decon chamber?
Yeah, the decon chamber.
So maybe you're listening to the decon chamber. No, it's got to be something that identifies. Battle Bridge.
And the logo of that will be us two completely naked with one of us rubbing the other one's back with gel.
No way! Hey, what? I have the dog in front of me?
Well, I don't have a dog.
All right, I'll be happy to rub my dog, but
and
behind me, on the other hand, just won't work.
Whenever we have guests, we'll have to meet in person and pose for the cover art.
Oh my god.
That's not good. Yeah. Well, somebody made the cover art for this show. I don't know what they're going to do for that one. Girl on girl on man on dog. Yes. Okay, so anyway, is there anything we forgot? You know, let me see. Do I have my virtual box running? No, I don't. I was going to say, because if I had virtual box, I would actually run that, do a Google search. And yeah, go ahead. I'm gonna start up virtual box while we're finishing up. Because I do want to do a Google search called Girl on Girl on Man on Dog and see where it takes me. Okay,
dude, do you mind snipping out that last sentence and putting it right at the front of the episode?
What? You're listening to Girl on Girl on Man on Dog.
Yeah, it'll be a nice, like, you know, a nice nice teaser.
Nah. Okay, I don't know. I don't know how to do that. Let's see. Alright, so it's now time for our final thoughts and ratings on this episode on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being the worst and 5 being the best. 1 being the worst and 5 being the girl on girl on man on dog. So, Chris from Glasgow in Scotland, what do you think of this episode on a scale of 1 to 5 and why?
So it's a really good follow on to the first part. I gave 5 for the first part, and I stand by that. I think it's probably the stronger of the two parts. It's not that this part is bad. I think it's just a few weak points, as we've mentioned as we went on. But it's still a strong story. I still like the concept of the reunification that Spock is on Romulus to try and push forward and see what he can do with it. I like the way the subplot all comes together from the Vulcan ships and what the Enterprise are up to. Well, Data and Picard are on Romulus. It flows really well. I just don't think it's quite as strong an episode as the first one on its own. So, although I would probably give a full 5 for the overall arc, I think this episode alone is probably only a 4.
James, how about you?
Well, I actually echo really a lot of what Chris says, but I actually don't have a problem giving this episode a 5 as well. It's not as good as the first part, so it's a low 5, quote unquote. But I honestly can't see anyone ever picking up, you know, no one starts at Unification Part 2 and no one ends at the end of Unification Part 1. I think it's been, I mean, we've had a lot of discussion about this. I think it's a very, very good story. Remember, this was a time when the Spock was really he was the first guy from the original series to do and to come on for TNG. You know, as really TNG was getting into its stride and really putting out a lot of great TV and becoming very popular. I know that we obviously had McCoy in the past, but that was more just a bit of a nod. This is really a full episode centered around Spock. So, you know, we've had this review of the episode. We haven't really spoken about the history of that actually happening. At the time, there still would have been a big difference between, quote, the original and you know, the next generation fan bases and universes. I think this is a great episode. I have a lot of fun. There's a lot of silliness in the second part as they're trying to wind things up, and the Sela caricature of the evil villain is not exactly very subtle, but I just really enjoy this episode for what it is. And I give it a 5 out of 5. Not the best in the world, but not much can be.
So it's interesting that you say that nobody does the second part, not the first part, because like the production order of this is that the second part was done first. Because it was something to do with Leonard Nimoy's timing. He could only have to do the Unification 2, then go back and film Unification 1.
Yes, so I think it's clear that I say clear, but it's they obviously didn't have Nimoy on for the entire full shoot of the two-parter. They obviously had him on for like, you know, an episode's worth of interactions. But I think that you know, given the limitations, you know, you can't just claim that you're going to have Nimoy on for the next four seasons, and you can't claim that, you know, you can have access to everything you want. So given the limitations that they had, which is, you know, one episode of Spock, I think they do really well at telling that story.
Okay. All right, well then, for me, I agree that this, I like this just as well as part one, if not even better, because there are more mysteries to solve, there are more things, there are more clues. I like the clues, and I like the way they all come together. And like you said, Chris, maybe I like this more because they did it first. They did this episode first before they filmed part one, I guess you'd call it. And just like they always do, whenever there's a two-parter, the second part usually lags a little bit, but it was still a 5 for part one. So this is still a great, great episode. It's not a top 5. Like James says, I do believe this is kind of a low grade temperature. So it's a low grade 5. But it's still just really, really good. I love the fact the Romulans think they've got them this time, and it turns out, no, they don't. I'm surprised there aren't more Romulan executions of all their leaders, because they're that inept. They get this close, and then they lose it all. So, that's it. And I'm looking over here. I did pull up VirtualBox, and the reason why I do that is I have Windows XP on VirtualBox with Windows Steady State. And if you're familiar with Steady State, whenever you reboot your system with Steady State running, all changes are erased. So it doesn't matter what virus I may get doing what I want to do on the VirtualBox. All I have to do is reboot the VirtualBox and the changes are erased. So when I said this girl on girl on man on dog, that really got me nothing. Except for a couple pictures of guys with leashes on their throats and on their four legs. So it really didn't do any good. And then I said Star Trek Enterprise, and that's when I got a little bit of Star Trek. As far as girl on girl on man on dog, really didn't do anything. But so it wasn't as fun as that. I thought it'd be. Yeah, I was hoping for some more excitement if I actually looked it up.
But, so to speak.
Yeah, so to speak. Oh well, what are you going to do? Disappointed again.
So you're disappointed that the internet is not filthy enough?
Right. Yes.
Can't remember many times that's been said.
Yeah. Yes. The things you depend on, and when those things don't happen, you're disappointed. Okay, so I'm going to save the guest list now, so we have our ratings in. We are now at 8 episodes for the season. And once again, James, hey, looks like you hate Star Trek now.
I do.
You do.
I just didn't think that Darmok was that good, and ever since that point, I've basically fallen off a cliff.
Silicon Avatar is the one you hated. That was a 2.
Yeah, but I mean, but everyone must have come in at a 2
for that. No. That's a brilliant episode.
No, it'd be ridiculous.
I have been rating that this season ridiculously high. I'm on an average of 4.625 at the moment.
Oh. Well, okay. Yeah, because I gave Silicon Avatar a 5.
What?
So did I.
Mm-hmm. Maybe there's like a naming thing that's gone on here, and we watched different episodes.
I don't know.
The weird one about thing. The crystalline entity doesn't do anything for me.
I'll have to really go in depth into the crystalline entity. And I like the and the kind of the depth of the doctor that's in it. So it's Dr. Marr. Yeah. And I love the ending. The ending is just fantastic. So, you think you'd be happy? No, I think you've just thrown away your life. I think your son would be gutted.
Yeah.
And it breaks our heart. It's such a tremendously strong ending.
Yes, that's why I say, you know, it's not about the Silicon Avatar. It's not about the crystalline entity. It was about the doctor. It was all about the doctor. And I love the doctor. I thought she was just completely off her rails. And that's what made her so, so good. But anyway, let's see. Kieran McDuff, I have you once again for Conundrum.
And seems here, obvious, doesn't it?
Doesn't it, though? And here's one thing I'm going to ask you to figure your best reason why. Don't answer it now, please. Why the hell didn't Kieran McDuff just make himself the captain? All would have been done the way he wants. Ah, don't answer.
No. That's an easy question to answer.
Okay, we'll find out in about 6 episodes.
A mysterious visitor from the future holds the key to a critical mission.
There are 20 million lives down there, and you know what will happen to them.
Will he help Picard save a dying planet?
It sounds to me like you're trying to manipulate the future.
Or watch a risky experiment trigger untold devastation.
Everyone dies, Captain.
Fire.
It's just a question of when.
Deadly Dilemma on Star Trek The Next Generation.
So everyone, join us next time as we review Episode 9 of Season 5 of Star Trek The Next Generation. And that will be A Matter of Time. So, Chris, thank you again for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, sir. Take care, everyone, and good night.
Good night.
Nighty night, all. Night, Chris. Say good night, Chris.
Good night, Chris.